life, I believe we can make it whole again. I believe we can make it whole.
They paved paradise, put up a parking lot with a pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hot spot. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paved paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth and telling where we're gonna plant our seed,
solar power, ever see a windmill go? Feel the pull of an ocean wave, the heat from a volcano. There's so much we could do, there's so much we could know, if we listen to the earth.
Every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein.
And this is EcoLogic. When your air or water is clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said. We open every show with environmental news and announcements.
The Pacifica bylaw, no vote, won by nearly 2-1. So for now, the WBAI airwaves are safe.
And I want to thank Donna for being such a major part of organizing the fight back to preserve WBAI. She did incredible work and getting a lot of thanks for it, so I want to do it publicly.
Thank you, Ken, and I want to thank the entire WBAI Fight Back team and the Phone Bank crew for all of their work mobilizing producers and listener supporters to vote. Voting is so important in every area that we have an opportunity to do it.
You know the environment is not some abstract thing. It's clean and healthy air, clean and healthy water, renewable energy jobs, energy efficiency jobs, sea level rise protection, storm surge protection, the morality of killing endangered species, the morality of environmental justice and environmental racism. It's our health and health costs. It's everyone's future. It's also the sheer beauty and wonder of nature. That's why EcoLogic exists and why it should exist.
On today's news and announcements, air pollution and coronavirus.
Success in reducing air pollution.
The fossil fuel industry is trying to take advantage of the pandemic. Damien Parrington has an article in the UK Guardian newspaper about air pollution impairing our lungs and making the coronavirus worse, but also mentioned that isolation measures are improving air quality. That's a silver lining. Smoking and air pollution make us more susceptible to coronavirus and many other diseases, so efficient uses of energy, mass transit, and higher mileage cars all help us keep healthier.
In a related story from the United Nations Good News Agency and the World Resources Institute comes good news about the fight against air pollution. The 40-year-old Convention on Long-Range Transboundary Air Pollution, or LRTAP, claims to have reduced emissions of particulate matter and sulfur by 30 to 80% since 1990 in Europe and 30 to 40% in North America. Of course, we lag behind. In Europe, these measures have extended life expectancy by a year. Nitrogen oxide releases have also halved. Unlike other environmental or climate change conventions, LRTAP, puts scientists in the same room as policymakers. No wonder it's working. For more info, go to our EcoLinks page.
You just knew this would happen, didn't you? The fossil fuel industry is trying to take advantage of the coronavirus pandemic, asking the federal government to pay them billions to keep oil prices artificially high. Amazing. The fossil fuel industry doesn't need or deserve the money. Protecting Americans from this pandemic is where the money should go. I'll bet everyone listening here can agree on that. We don't often mention petitions on Ecologic, but for this we're making an exception and link to a Center for Biodiversity petition from our EcoLinks page.
And finally, quoting a short article in Time Out magazine, the World Health Organization, WHO, WHO, announced that dogs cannot contract COVID-19. Dogs previously held in quarantine can be released. Liam Hackett added, to be clear, WHO let the dogs out?
A corporation called Holtec is buying up nuclear power plants that are being decommissioned. What could go wrong? Holtec has a history of incompetence and cutting corners and using connections in Washington to get away with it. With all of the Indian Point radioactive waste stored on site, Holtec is not a company that should be in charge. New York Attorney General Letitia James opposes a Holtec transfer. Hudson River Sloop Clearwater, Riverkeeper, Indian Point Safe Energy Coalition, and other local environmental groups urge people to contact the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to tell them not to allow Holtec to take over Indian Point. Please go to the links on the ecoradio.org page to follow what is happening and learn why Holtec is a bad idea.
And from Sane Energy Project comes this. Williams Pipeline activism continues. New Yorkers and elected officials call on utilities to halt pipeline construction to protect workers and communities during public health crisis. A Con Edison construction worker in Queens has already tested positive for COVID-19. National Grid continues to push for the Williams NESC pipeline and a slew of other horrendous fossil fuel infrastructure proposals, even amidst the COVID-19 crisis that has brought all other business and activity to a halt. It's incredibly important for us to speak out against National Grid's disastrous fracked gas pipeline proposals like the Williams NESC pipeline and an offshore liquefied natural gas terminal.
We will provide links for you to take action on the ecoradio.org page.
Yes. Environment TV airs on Manhattan Neighborhood Network every other Sunday at 11 a.m., and it's often a video version of Ecologic. The next one is two Sundays from now. But it also airs during the week, during the evening. You might see Environment TV any time of the day. They like it and repeat it.
To read the full articles we summarized on any episode of Ecologic from the past few years, we link to those articles on the Eco-Links page of the Eco-Logic website, which is www.ecoradio.org.
Our Facebook page is WBAI Ecologic, no spaces or dashes, WBAI Ecologic. And please click like. And there are links to more environmental news on our EcoLinks page. Ecoradio.org is the main page, and that'll get you to past guests, EcoLinks, and our own permanent archives. The show that you're listening to right now will be one of them. Ecoradio.org. Keep that website bookmarked. So welcome, everybody, to our very first podcast radio show. And there's a lot of you joining in so that we have listener phone calls when we get to that part of the show. And I especially want to welcome Abby Hafer for being our first guest in this format of a show. Abby is an absolutely amazing person. She is an author of several books. She's a biologist. She teaches nursing students, so the next generation is in her hands, and what great hands they are. She has been talking to microbiologists and physicians to prepare for this show. So the information that she has for you is just absolutely wonderful. Thank you, Abby, and welcome to Ecologic.
Hi, Ken. Thanks for having me.
I'm so proud. We had you on Ecologic last week. on WBAI. That's archived on the WBAI.org website and ecoradio.org. There's a direct link to it. And a lot's happened since then. I don't know how much we should summarize since there's been so much information out there. But I have noticed in New York City there's a lot less people walking around, although some days more than others. So people are paying attention. Why are these measures so important?
Okay. Well, as a matter of fact, this leads into what I was going to start with anyway, which are some notes from physicians that I know. And one of them, who is an emergency room doctor, basically says that the social distancing, as this is called, is extremely useful because basically, and this is now me talking, not the ER doc, but basically what happens is that the virus is exhaled out of people's lungs or is coughed out when they cough or sneezed out when they sneeze. And the viruses remain in the air for up to 3 hours, which is not fun, and then they will fall to the ground and fall on various surfaces, which is why the two things that we keep being told about are first having to do with surfaces to, you know, wear gloves and wash your hands and basically don't touch things and don't touch your face, because one route of transmission is touching surfaces and then touching your face with your now pestilential hand. And the other is just the problem of the viruses hanging about in the air for up to 3 hours. So those are the ways that they can be picked up by other people. And so simply maintaining your distance is going to mean that you are much less likely to wind up getting this virus. So that's what the social distancing, or as someone else has called it, physical distancing, is really about, and that's why we keep being told to wash our hands. So does this make sense?
It does to me.
And a couple of other things to note, I mean, the usual basics, if you're going to cough or sneeze, do it into your shoulder or elbow. If you do manage to sneeze or cough into your hand, go wash your hands immediately. Mm-hmm. Don't touch other people with your pestilential hands. One way to look at it that I think is somewhat useful is, in a way, think of yourself as already having the virus and that your actions are doing what you can to keep from giving it to others. So you're going to stay a safe distance away. You're going to cough into your shoulder. You're going to do these other things to help other people, to keep other people safe, as well as trying to keep yourself safe. And if you're up for it, you can also keep a record of the people you come into contact with so that authorities can track the disease. But the social distancing measures really work. Basically, South Korea was way on top of this and was doing a great job. They, of course, had lots of testing, which helps to track a disease down. But then it got away from them, and basically the sort of renewed outbreak can be traced back to one individual known as Patient 31, who was sick or was not yet symptomatic, didn't realize they were sick, went around and did things and, you know, had lunch with people and got into a minor automobile accident and did a bunch of other things like this.
Wow.
Which then proceeded to infect lots of other people. And this virus is very infectious. The latest estimates that I saw are that for every one person who is infected, another three will get it. So those are just horrible numbers, unfortunately.
Are you saying that patient 31 thought he was recovered and then got reinfected?
No, patient 31 did not realize that they had the disease.
Oh, good. I mean, that's good.
And then, you know, went about their lives, and unfortunately that did create further problems. Now, regarding, actually, you bring up reinfection, and what I've been reading about that is, and again, you know, this is a new disease, but if it acts like every other viral disease ever, then getting it should confer immunity. But I'm going to put sort of a big asterisk on that, because this may wind up behaving like the flu, which is to say it mutates. So we can develop a vaccine for it, and we can develop immunity, you know, through getting it. Both of those are ways of exposing yourself to the disease.
Well,
and that exposure will confer immunity to this variety of the novel coronavirus. But, you know, in a year or two's time, there may be some mutations. This is why there's a flu shot every year. Remember, the original influenza pandemic was light, was this bad. We may surpass it this time around, but it was a horrible, horrible pandemic in 1918. And the remnants of it today are what we call the flu. And this is why there's a new flu shot every year. And I would not be surprised if the novel coronavirus winds up assuming a role eventually like the flu, a horrible pandemic the first time around. It may come in waves, but people will become immune through exposure, is my guess. But that since there will be mutations, there may again sort of have to be a yearly coronavirus shot to take care of whatever strains appear to be the ones that are coming up next. That would be my guess as to how that particular aspect of all this plays out.
Well, you know that I've been following that particular aspect pretty closely, as I am now on the other side of the coronavirus infection. And I know that the listening to my own voice right now, I'm pretty happy with how strong I am. The experts that I've heard are pretty, including the doctors and the nurses in the hospital last week, are all pretty confident that the once you have it, you're immune, and that makes me smile, but for on a personal level. But they can't say for sure. But like you're saying right now, there is a possibility that it is here to stay and it will reinfect. But supposedly the degrees in which you it will remain or reinfect will be lighter and lighter and lighter, not stronger and stronger and not the same. So pretty much it's good news for people who are recovered. So
does that mean we should all go hang out with Donna because she had a light version of it?
No. I don't know how light it was, but but I got over it quickly.
The whole issue here, as has been discussed at length, is that we basically want to spare the hospital system. So we're trying to keep the cases as few in number as humanly possible, so that our medical resources can actually cope with the people who do get sick. That's the whole, that when people talk about flattening the curve, that's what they're talking about. We do not want a spike in cases which will overwhelm the medical system. I mean, that's what you're already dealing with or about to deal with in New York, is my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they think that Westchester may have reached their peak and New York City is still a week or two away, which with the number of people who have it is kind of a scary thought.
Yes. So this does actually bring up, I think the mildness or strongness of the case does not depend upon the virus you get, but on, you know, all kinds of other factors about how you're doing and this kind of thing. It's really hard to tell. So, you know, you may get exposed to the exact same, you know, virus, but have very different responses.
But
what you said about
sparing the hospital system, I'd like to bring up a point that, if you're just feeling suspecting, like I did in the beginning, suspecting that perhaps you know, any illness that you feel, anything that sounds like it could be, you think maybe you have it, it's not a reason to go to the hospital system or you need to give them a break. It's when you start feeling shortness of breath. Definitely call the hospital system at that point. And that's when it's a respiratory illness, and that's when there's danger. But just in the beginning, I just felt tired. I didn't know for sure it was coronavirus. I've been going through family stuff, so it was understandable that I was tired and not sleeping. But then some of the other symptoms came along, and it wasn't until I had shortness of breath that they came and got me. So spare the hospital system, as Abby just said.
Yeah, thank you. And that actually brings up another point that my emergency room physician emphasized, which is just exactly that. If you're really ill, then, of course, go to the hospital, but otherwise stay at home simply because hospital beds are at such a premium and are going to be at such a premium for quite a while.
And in order to be safe, nutrition is really important.
Oh, yeah.
So everybody, eat your vegetables, eat your fruits, quit smoking, get plenty of sleep, all the things that you've been hearing your entire life. They've never been more important than they are right now. Yeah, exercise, sunlight, all the cliches.
Vitamin C, vitamin D, very important.
And since this is a respiratory disease, again, we will reemphasize, yeah, quit smoking.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to have that air pollution stuff in the news section, because there's, you know, air pollution is an aspect of things, and the fact that it's air pollution is better is important as well.
Right, and I'm going to bring up something that I read about the Chinese crisis, which was that, you know, during the height of the epidemic in Wuhan, I mean, we now have data on who lived and who died and who got it and who didn't. And one of the really scary things there was that men died at a far greater rate. I mean, lots of people got it. But in terms of who died, I mean, anybody can die of it. And that is worth remarking. The only thing that I have not seen is anybody under the age of 9 dying, and that information could be old. But the ratios were something like 3 men died for every 1 woman who died in China, and we don't know if that's a male-female thing or if it's because nearly all men in China smoke and nearly all women don't.
God.
So, wow,
as I said, there's a good reason to stop smoking.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
And here I was just thinking it was that women are more conscious and careful.
Well, I mean, lots of things can factor into it. And remember, all I did was tell you some raw numbers, you know, so factoring out all of those things. Well, that's what epidemiologists do, and they're very busy right now. And we will find out a lot as time goes on.
Thank you, Abby.
This organism that's causing COVID-19 is just recently evolved, right?
Yes. Yes. The way that this works is that, well, as I said last time around, mutations in a few strands of viral RNA have, you know, at this point completely changed the world, its health, and the economy. And, yes, it evolved. And what happened, we don't even know its exact sort of route of evolution, but it was in animals before both bats and pangolins get coronaviruses. And ordinarily, you know, diseases are fairly species-specific, which is even if I get COVID-19, my cats will not. But on the other hand, every now and then, a mutation takes place that allows a virus, you know, a whole new host species, which in this case was us, and that is evolution, absolutely. So this thing evolved, and now we're stuck with it. And it, meanwhile, is evolutionarily speaking far too successful for our tastes because it can now, as I said, exploit this whole new population of organisms, namely human beings, and, you know, that's how viruses propagate.
Abby, you do not have to be diplomatic towards the disease. It will not have feelings that will get hurt.
Oh, no, it's just that people often get upset when an evolutionary biologist says something like this virus is very successful. They don't like that kind of language. These are viruses that kill us. We shouldn't think of them as successful.
Yeah.
But from an evolutionary standpoint, it is a success right now.
Oh, no.
Yeah, okay. When I read that bats and pangolins, and, you know, I'm thinking China because pangolins are, they're also called spiny anteaters. They're these scaly, fascinating creatures, the most heavily trafficked animal on Earth. And
yeah, I find that weird, but there we are.
Yeah, and they're
I had no idea that there was such traffic in pangolins, of all things.
Yeah, and well, there are several environmental groups that have been trying to stop it and raise consciousness about it, and it's used in Chinese medicine. And I'm just wondering if the Chinese medicine has any link to the COVID-19 being able to leap. There was an article, there's one on from the BBC and one in the Science News magazine that I'm going to link to on our EcoLinks page, and it mentions that the genetics of COVID-19 that we have is most similar to the horseshoe bat, with one exception, which is that the part of the gene that allows it to infect us is more similar in the pangolin. So,
mm-hmm. Well, and you can have things that go through steps as well. So this virus, might have taken a couple of steps before it got to us, and started in pangolins and then moved to bats and then moved to people. I mean, we don't know at this point. Now, we have sequenced the entire genome. We did that, when I say we, I mean humankind, knew the sequence of the RNA in early January. And this actually brings me up to another thing that I sent to Ken, which is, so we've had the sequence for a little while now, but at this point I also was sent an article that describes the crystal structure of the main protease in the COVID-19 virus.
And could you tell our listeners how that affects any future knowledge?
Yep. Here's what's going on. This was sent to me by another medical doctor, a friend of mine, who was very reasonably grousing about the stupid comments and myths about hydrochloroquine and chloroquine, which are malaria drugs. And as my friend put it, the malaria parasite, which is Plasmodium falciparum, is a parasite, and SARS-CoV-2 is a virus, and it is unlikely that the same drug would inhibit both completely unrelated organisms. In the same way as you would not expect that a drug designed for getting rid of tapeworms would also get rid of herpes. It's just not a good bet. Whereas, this friend says, so now that we have the crystal structure of one of the proteases, what this basically comes down to is that this virus has to break down proteins as a part of what it does. And in chemistry, any time that you see the suffix ace, that tells you that it breaks something down. So a protease breaks down protein. All right, you with me on this? So a protease breaks down proteins, and the virus has to have this protease in order to stay alive and infect people. So now that we have the crystal structure of that protease, we can set about designing a drug to basically interrupt that protease, at which point the virus can't live. So this would be a designer drug aimed at that particular type of crystal, which can be modeled on a computer, and we can try different ways of going about trying to basically crack it up. So, this is a very specific way of going around trying to find a medicine. In the end, this is probably what it is going to take. I'm all in favor of trying anything that we already have available to us, simply because they have already gone through phase one trials, so we know that they do not hurt people and that will speed up people being able to use them. So any drugs that are already available, I'm fine with the idea of trying them to see if they have any kind of effect.
Right. But I thought that the hydrochloroquine would help the pneumonia to hurry up and clear.
Well, there were anecdotal reports from China that it might sort of reduce the duration and severity of the symptoms, but they were strictly anecdotal reports. So we are now doing trials on it to see if it works at all, but we don't actually know, because that's what an anecdote is. It's something that is simply something that is suspected.
The problem is that
they are deadly in even minor overdoses. And even, in fact, I have people I know who have taken them for malaria because they've been traveling in malarial countries have said it's an awful drug in any case. They would avoid taking it if they could. I mean, I suppose it would be better than dying. Of course, it's why they took it, to prevent malaria. But the problem is that it is deadly in even small overdoses, and people have already died because they did this, trying to keep from getting COVID-19. And the other problem is that these drugs are used by people who need them, including lupus patients, who now can't get the drugs they need.
Right. And, Abby, I did hear the doctors were telling me that it was a benign drug and that it was readily available. But like you say, I've heard that people who need it are having a hard time finding it. It was what the people who suffered from it are people who just had it in the house or something else, and took it as a preventative because they heard on the radio that it was good, and they took it without medical awareness. I was given it for 5 days, 400 milligrams at a time with antibiotics. I have no idea whether or not it helped or not. It didn't hurt me. But I don't know if it speeded along the healing or not. I wouldn't have any way of knowing that.
Right.
But I'm not feeling that it hurt me in any way. Whatever. Okay.
It's interesting having Donna here who has experienced this.
And I want to put a shout out to Mount Sinai Roosevelt for the heroic hospital staff. The nurses, the doctors, the technicians, they were all wonderful.
I guess I should thank the free conference call people for this service. If you have a question for Dr. Hafer, speak your name. Donna will write down everybody's name and then call on you one by one so we can have an orderly. Anybody want to ask a question? I've unmuted everybody's phone.
Jenny Hurwitz.
Alice.
Okay, Jenny, go for it.
Yeah, it's so good to hear you, Donna, and and Ken. So my understanding was that this virus, COVID-19, was not a kind of virus like measles, where it's so transmissible through the air that it was more droplet.
And if you're not speaking, please put your phone on mute now that we've unmuted you.
She mentioned measles, which is a bacterial disease that is contagious through the air. And the virus, from what everybody can see, is transmissible through droplet transmission. But unfortunately, some respiratory droplets are very small. It's more or less when you exhale. You can have some droplets in the air. So, yeah, there's a lot of question now to the extent to which this thing aerosolizes, as it is known, basically hangs in the air. And what I have been hearing recently is that it can hang in the air for up to 3 hours. So it's not like measles quite, but this is why, as I said, we keep talking about social distancing.
And so is that why a mask works, because it's droplets?
Okay, masks. This is a really good topic. First of all, masks are very good for keeping you from giving your disease to other people.
Right.
It's a really fine thing to do, to wear a mask as a kindness to others. In terms of how well they protect you, if you have an actual surgical mask or one of these N95 masks or all these kinds of things, if they are properly fitted and there's no air gaps or this kind of thing, then that should filter out the vast majority of the viruses in the air as you're inhaling. Anything appears to be better than nothing, but that's not a high standard. as I said, for wearing anything, you are doing other people a favor if you do that, because it will reduce the likelihood of you giving it to somebody else.
The other advantage of wearing a mask is to remind you to not touch your face.
That's a very good point, yes, absolutely. Now, people are doing a lot of sewing of masks now. A lot of people have a lot of different opinions on this. There are ones out now, or designs out now, that involve two layers of cloth with a filter in between. And I've even seen people say, and this actually stands up to at least a certain amount of reason, that the filter could even just be something like Kleenex or toilet paper. Basically, you want a non-woven tissue between you and the air, because the viruses are less likely to be able to get through that. Any woven material has holes that are the size of a superhighway as far as viruses are concerned. So, the race is on to try and figure out how to come up with a good cloth mask, because right now we have shortages of absolutely everything. So it's all up in the air. There are armies of people who are sewing masks for hospitals right now. It's one of the most heartening things that I've seen. I hope it works. I suspect it works to at least a degree, but I don't know what the degree is. If you have a cloth mask, be sure to wash it frequently. Soap and water does kill this virus, so washing it actually works. If you have one that involves a filter in between, take the filter out. If it's something like Kleenex or toilet paper, take it out frequently and put in a new one. I would say every little bit helps, but it is hard to know how good these things are. Where our hospital personnel are concerned, it's an absolute travesty that we are not getting them the equipment that they need.
And there is a myth about the masks. The hospital staff told me that if they wash the mask, it makes them useless. So they can't.
It's with paper masks. There's no point in washing a paper mask because it'll change the fibers in the mask.
Okay. Next question is from Alice or anybody else that wants to shout out the name to be on stack.
Yeah, Tom.
Susan.
Hey.
All right, Alice.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for the great show. My question is on the 3 hours in the air. That I didn't know about. And if someone's in a supermarket for shopping, even if we're keeping our social distance, if someone's been there before and has coughed or has the virus, we have a possibility of contracting it just by breathing the air in that space. Is that right?
Okay, so here's the way it works. As I said, the coughing or the sneezing is what's most likely to aerosolize these things. Yes, it's a problem. It absolutely is. I still think the social distancing is likely to do a lot of good. What you're really trying to do is reduce what's called the viral load. And you can do that through all of these techniques. But this is why I would not be opposed to the idea of wearing a mask in the supermarket. Because, anything you can do to reduce the chances of coming across some aerosolized viruses is a good idea so far as I can see. Now, the problem here is we really do want to reserve the really good masks for medical personnel. They are the ones who are being exposed to the virus far more than we are. But this is also why basically you don't go to the supermarket just to, pick up a new roll of toilet paper. We really do need to space out our trips to the supermarket, have them be uncrowded if possible, and the like, because it is potentially a problem.
Okay, Tom, then Susan, and Faith, I'll call on you one at a time. Is there anyone else that would like to put their name on stack? Okay, Tom, go ahead.
Okay, my question is, at the beginning of the show you talked, and just now you talked about when somebody exhales, it's in the air for 3 hours. But you mentioned that it lands on surfaces, the virus. And I have a lot of friends and neighbors that are afraid that if they walk on the sidewalk and somebody sneezes there, they're getting it on their shoes. Or if we buy things from the supermarket, maybe a farm worker sneezed on the vegetables, or people are afraid to get their mail from the in the mailbox. So can you talk about how the virus lands on surfaces and what happens to it? And does it disappear in 3 hours? Thank you.
Okay. There's a bunch of questions there. So I will start out that the three-hour thing appears to be how long it can remain in the air. It will eventually settle down onto surfaces. And there's new information out now about how long the viruses can be alive on various different surfaces. Now, as far as walking around on the ground goes, you know, it couldn't hurt to take your shoes off at the door and then wash your hands. You know, I usually do not go about smelling the bottoms of my shoes, so I don't think there's going to be too much likelihood of transmission if you just, you know, take off your shoes and leave them at the door and then go wash your hands. I think that would take care of that issue. Regarding touching stuff, again, this is why you're supposed to wash your hands. It is why I personally wear gloves every time I go out. That also reminds me to not touch my face, is wearing gloves. It's kind of a way of retraining yourself in a lot of ways. But there's information out as to how long the viruses stay alive on different surfaces. So I would recommend, for instance, there's information, as I recall, that the viruses can stay alive on cardboard for 24 hours. I personally am interpreting paper as being like cardboard. So when I get the mail, I actually put the mail in my front hall and then go wash my hands, and I don't look at it for a day on the presumption that any viruses that were on the mail will be dead after 24 hours. You know, again, this is my guess, but I'm basing it on what I have read about how long the viruses last on different surfaces.
I heard something on that, Abby, that you can take the mail, take the packages, open them up, throw away the packaging or the outside envelope, and go wash your hands, and then it will be okay there. As long as you don't...
That would be a way of doing it, too.
As long as you wash your hands and you do not touch your face, including the droplets in the air, it's going to land somewhere. So just, it's okay as long as you don't touch your face and wash your hands. Two of the most important things. You can even live with a family member who has the disease and never get the disease yourself if you follow those two protocols.
You were saying follow these two protocols. The two protocols are?
Washing your hands and not touching your face.
There we go. Thank you.
Now, money is like a rag of paper. Does it have 24 hours?
I'm assuming the same thing applies, yeah. Now, the thing that's weird is that if you get a 20 out of your ATM machine, that's probably been sitting there for a long time and it hasn't had a human touching it for quite a while. And by the way, you can clean your credit cards and your iPhones using alcohol wipes. In the absence of alcohol wipes, if you've got a bottle of isopropyl around, you know, you can put that onto a tissue and gently wipe your phone and your credit card and this kind of thing, and that apparently works perfectly well.
Oh, that's good to hear. My friend Peter is a super in a small building, and he's just going around the entire building with isopropyl and washing down everybody's doorknobs.
Oh,
so,
that's super.
Yeah.
That's great.
He's a super super.
A super super, right.
Okay, so the next person on stack is Susan. And then Faith. Okay, Susan, go for it.
Thank you. Abby, you are the first person I've heard from that said that the droplets remain in the air for hours. I live and work near Central Park, and when the sun is out, I go for walks since I'm very cooped up because I'm a psychologist and I'm doing all my sessions by phone or online, so I need to go out. And I've been pretty careful in terms of the hand washing and the avoidance, 6 feet and all that. But I never heard about this droplet staying in the air for a long time. So I was walking in the park, and on reflection, I'm remembering people running. They probably, when they're running, they're breathing heavily and exhaling. And I probably walked into their droplets without knowing that. You know what I mean? So that's a new piece of information. And
yeah.
It seems like there's no way to really avoid it if you walk outdoors. Unless you stand at the corner and watch who's walking by and time it. Seems to be no way to protect yourself from the air.
Yeah. Abby, I'm hearing that the droplets have to land. And if you're in the outdoors, there's wind blowing, and I don't think those droplets are anything but very much dissipated. I don't think we have. From what I've been studying, because I have personal situation here, the droplets in the air are not easily transferable, and that the it's where they land, and that's why the droplets in the air are not as much of a danger unless they're landing on something, you're touching it, and you're touching to your face. So you need to, once again, wash your hands and don't touch your face. But it's walking into one of my suspicions of how I contracted the coronavirus was that one, and there's several, was one woman on a bus, had a mask on, and she took her mask off to cough.
Oh, God.
I was not happy about that. So I think that the mask would have caught her cough, and that would have been better. I have no idea if that was one of the culprits, but it's when the droplets touch something and then you touch that and then touch your face is the biggest danger. So I don't think we need to be as worried about walking into the droplets in the air from what I've heard. Want to speak to that, Abby?
Yes. Well, again, this is what the social distancing is all about. Basically, as Donna said early on, the air outside is a huge volume of air, and it's moving. There is wind. The viruses are going to get dissipated pretty quickly, even on a still day outside. So I would really not be that concerned so long as you keep your distance from people.
The next
Thank
person
you.
With a question is Faith. Is there anyone else that would like to put their name on stack?
May I put my name on? Sarah.
All right, Faith.
Hi, I pretty much just wanted to say welcome back, Donna. And,
thank you.
I've been wearing a bandana to go out, but, I mean, I would just think that if we wore a couple of fabrics around our face, isn't that better than going out with nothing?
I hear is that the reason that a bandana could be any useful at all is to remind yourself to not touch your face.
Mm-hmm.
Because it does not protect you, because there's no restriction of the air that's coming in. So, Abby?
Well, again, what a bandana is really good for, in addition to keeping from touching your face, she said coughing into her elbow, is that it will help prevent you from giving the disease to others. If you go out with a bandana on, if you cough or sneeze or breathe, it's going into the bandana. The droplets, the moisture, is going to be going into the bandana. And so you're doing other people a favor by doing that. I have gathered from what I've read about the situation in medical wards is the word is out that if you have nothing else, wear a bandana because it's better than nothing. But that's about all that can be said for it in terms of keeping you from getting the disease. Because as Donna said, there are so many holes and other ways for the virus to get to you And viruses are so small that, you know, they will go in around the air gaps around your nose and under the bandana and all of that kind of thing.
I just wanted to say, so even if I'm not sick, I could be, any of us could be a carrier at this point?
Yes.
Okay.
And that is a good reason to wear a bandana, because you might be a carrier, and not giving it to others is a really good deed.
And when you're asymptomatic, you're still able to transfer it. That's another reason why young people that think that they're invincible still have family members that they go home to. So everybody needs to practice social distancing and safe procedures. We have time for one more question, and we have one more person on stack, so that's perfect. Sarah?
Yes, hi. Hi, Donna. I'm so glad you're well again.
Thank you.
Why did you choose to go to a hospital?
Did I choose?
Well, what happened?
No,
I joined. You had already spoken.
Just quickly, my story was that around the 10th, I was feeling very, very tired. I had just come back from a family sadness and wasn't sleeping well, so I thought that I just was exhausted from not sleeping well after losing somebody in my family. But then, and like anybody, I suspected that I might have corona, but, you know, you don't know. Everybody suspects it. I went to urgent care. They would not test me for coronavirus because I didn't have a high temperature, which I did not have much of a high temperature, just a slight temperature the whole time, except for two spikes. And they wouldn't test me. They tested me for flu. I was pretty sure I didn't have the flu, but that was one of the criteria. So I didn't have the flu, and they sent me home. My doctor said to call 311. I wasn't in a hurry for that. It didn't seem like necessary. And so several days later, I developed shortness of breath. I developed shortness of breath, I called 311, and they were knocking on my door before I had a chance to put my things together. It was that fast.
Wow.
So we ask you to avoid going and taxing the hospital system. If you're just feeling some of the symptoms, and by the way, all of the symptoms are not felt by all of the people. There are just a few. I didn't feel all of the symptoms, just took a few. But once you have a shortness of breath and you have interacted with somebody personally who was diagnosed, which I didn't have somebody like that in my life, but she was asymptomatic. But she was diagnosed. But once you have shortness of breath, it's a respiratory illness, and that's when they want you. And they didn't even have tests in the hospital. They just did a chest X-ray and found that part of one lobe had pneumonia, but not a whole lobe. So I never got bad pneumonia, but since I never had it, I didn't know what I was experiencing. And in a week, I was all better. Once they could take the oxygen out of my nose and my O2 levels were still high, that's when I was ready to go. And once I could yawn without coughing, I knew I was good to go. And I'm very, very happy to be on the other side of this damn thing. And they don't have any tests for you to find out that you're free of it, so the assumption is that you still self-isolate for 2 weeks before you go out in public, but then I'm going to be Wonder Woman and I can go and do anything I want to do. So I'm very happy to be on the other side of this, and in 2 weeks, if anybody needs some help, call me and I'll go get your groceries.
Oh,
that's wonderful.
I'm so glad you're well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Abby, I'm sure one of the main questions everybody has is, how long is this going to last? When will this be over? Do you have any idea?
Oh, that depends on everything is the problem, because, of course, it's hitting different regions of the country at different times. And to an extent, it kind of depends upon how successful we are at flattening the curve. because if we do that, then our hospital resources will not be overwhelmed, but it will mean that people essentially get sicker in smaller numbers for a longer time. So who knows when this is going to end. I personally wouldn't really plan on things being back to normal, even semi-normal, for a few months. Obviously, as people recover, as Donna has done, you know, they can walk about and do things, and, you know, there will be more people available to do things, but it's going to be a long and slow process, and I wouldn't think there would be any safety in mass gatherings for quite a few months to come, particularly since we're still trying to protect the vulnerable, the older and sicker in the population. It's the same thing as Donna was saying before. You know, even as the crisis passes, the illness will still be around for quite a while, and if I wind up getting it, you know, in July, we can certainly hope that I don't give it to my mother. So, you know, this, it's going to continue to be a problem. The good news is that the longer we buy time, which is what this is all about, the longer we will have to develop effective treatments and, of course, in the long run, a vaccine. And everybody has been emphasizing that will probably take 18 months before there is an available vaccine that people can have. But at least it's a timeline. And as I said, I suspect that we will develop treatments which will not immunize you, but will at least, you know, keep you from the worst outcomes of this disease. You know, I'm hoping that those come online sooner, and I know that people are working very hard on them. There are a couple of things that I would just like to bring up before the show ends. One is that there are people who are busy trying to teach their kids at home. And we talked about evolution earlier in the show, and there is a wonderful organization called TIES, the Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science. And they have put up two wonderful modules about evolution, one for middle school students and one for high school students. So if people are looking for ways to teach their kids at home, here are some modules that have been put up by a very good organization. I haven't seen the modules myself, but I've worked with this organization before, and they are very good. So I suspect that these are very good teaching modules, and they are used to working with teachers who work with middle school students. So they will also include fun stuff as well as just the information. So I wanted to pass that along. Visit the TIES website, Teacher Institute for Evolutionary Science, and see what they've got to offer there. And
we'll put
also
that on our EcoRadio link page, ecoradio.org.
Okay, I will send that link to Ken. And also, I actually have a website of my own that I was planning on developing this spring anyway, and it's still in process, but it exists, and that is called professionaldebunker.com. That is my website. It's still being put up, but I am trying to list some links there regarding COVID-19.
Okay. And what are the names of your books, your wonderful books?
My books are both about evolution in different ways. One is called The Not-So-Intelligent Designer, Why Evolution Explains the Human Body and Intelligent Design Does Not. And that's what it sounds like. That's basically looking at bad human body parts. And I teach human anatomy and physiology. I'm familiar with them. And the other book is called Darwin's Apostles. This is my new one. It just came out late last year. Darwin's Apostles, the men who fought to have evolution accepted, their times, and how the battle continues. And that was co-authored with Dr. David Orenstein, who is at the City University of New York.
Thank you.
They are wonderful books. Abby has a wonderful writing style. I met her at a lecture, and I was completely entranced by your ability to give all this information with a sense of humor. Just one of the best lectures I've ever heard.
Oh, well, gee whiz. Thank you.
So I'm so happy to have had you on Ecologic a few times.
Yes.
And we will have Abby giving
updates on a regular basis on our show.
And one other thing I want to add about Professor Hafer is she makes the best trilobite-shaped challah bread that I've ever had.
All right.
Well, thank you very much, Abby, and thanks to everybody who were our listener phone calls for this show. Thanks, Abby, for all your wonderful work. And thank you, Donna, for all your wonderful work.
My pleasure.
Well, thanks, okay. Ken, for putting this together.
I wasn't looking to be an example of the situation, but I'm glad to be on the other side of it.
Yeah, right.
See the sun, how bright it shines on the nations of the earth. All who share this thing called life celebrate each day's rebirth.
Soul.